Blog Talk Radio.
Of his terrible sword,
Good evening, and we begin tonight with the deadly attacks that played out today at two separate locations in Tennessee. What authorities are treating as a, quote, act of domestic terrorism, and almost immediately today, the concern. Who might have inspired these attacks? Here's what we know at this hour, a single shooter with a massive arsenal. Pulling up to this recruiting center first, you can see the glass shattered there. Then the second shooting just a few miles away, sparking this massive police response. A naval support center where four Marines were shot and killed. The shooter then killed by police. Outside that second location tonight, these images coming in, the convertible right there, authorities say the gunman was driving. And tonight, authorities identifying the suspect as this 24-year-old man from Tennessee. We do have team coverage this evening, beginning with ABC's Jim Avila and the moment the terror began.
Tonight, bullet holes and shell casings at the military recruiting center where the rampage began. 10:45, a man in a silver Ford Mustang convertible, the top down, driving into the strip mall. Offices here for all four branches of the military.
He just pulled up, and next thing you know, he lifted up his arms like this with a big black gun, and just, it was one shot, and then it was just endless shots, one after another, just unloading into the Army.
Dozens of shots. One Marine hit in the leg, but within seconds, the gunman flees, racing 7 miles down the highway to a Navy Reserve support center. The sound of gunfire is heard, where he kills four Marines and is shot to death. Authorities now identifying him as 24-year-old Mohammed Yosef Abdulaziz. And tonight, those aerial pictures, his silver Mustang found abandoned at the scene. Chattanooga, now a city in crisis.
This is a very, very terrible situation, and we need to go figure out how we can handle it.
Hospital emergency rooms locked down. Local colleges, too. Back at the strip mall, terrified workers barricading themselves inside stores and restaurants. But 30 minutes after the first shots were fired, it was all over.
We are treating this as an act of domestic terrorism.
Tonight, a community in shock. This young woman carrying roses to honor those who were killed on this terrible day.
David, tonight, the Chattanooga mayor says this attack was incomprehensible and a nightmare, one being felt across the country. David?
Mohammed Yosef Abdulaziz grew up in this middle-class neighborhood in Chattanooga. He had four sisters. He was the only son. His parents, Yosef and Razmia, are Palestinians from Jordan, who moved to the U.S. and became American citizens. But there was turmoil inside the family home. In 2009, Mohammed's mother filed for divorce, claiming in court documents her husband abused her and the children, and even threatened to take a second wife in their, quote, native state of Palestine. The suit was dropped, and the parents signed an agreement that the husband agrees to not inflict any personal injury, harm, or insult upon the wife or upon any of the children of their marriage. Abdulaziz went on to college, graduated with an electrical engineering degree in 2012. According to a resume he posted online, he worked at several internships. It was during this time he was also traveling to the Middle East. Jordanian officials confirmed Mohammed Abdulaziz had an extended visit in 2014. And a close friend tells CNN, Abdulaziz came back a changed man. He distanced himself, the friend said. And though they'd known each other since they were 5 years old, he says he never became close to me like he was before he went overseas. At a news conference Friday, the FBI confirmed it was looking into Abdulaziz's overseas travels, his possible connections, but so far says there is no one else involved.
We have no indication that he was inspired by or directed by anyone other than himself.
In the past 3 months, Abdulaziz took a new job and moved to the Nashville area. His most recent photo from a mugshot taken in April when he was arrested for DUI. Almir Dizdarevich saw Abdulaziz just last month.
I said, brother, how are you doing? I haven't seen you in a while. How's everything? You doing all right? Smiling, laughing, talking to me, no problems. And another guy just talked on the phone about a case. He said he saw him just a day ago at a local store, and he said absolutely nothing. He was shaking hands, saying, you know, how are you doing? Everything's fine.
Friends confirmed to CNN Abdulaziz had returned to Chattanooga this week to visit his family, prayed with them during this final week of Ramadan. One told us he was here at this mosque just this past weekend. Today, on one of the most festive days in the Muslim year, the mosque is closed. A sign on its door states, "The families of the victims are in our thoughts and prayers."
This man, Muhammad Yusuf Abdulaziz, was born in Kuwait. We know that he grew up in the area of Tennessee, according to authorities, near where these shootings took place. We don't know a lot about him other than the FBI was not tracking him.
Look, unless this is an unbelievable coincidence of a psychotic who happens to carry his name who went out of control, this is in all probability an example of radical Islam at work. And, you know, I think our emphasis on ISIS is a little overstated because we had these attacks that predate ISIS. Nidal Hassan, when he shot up and killed 13 Americans, stood up on a table and yelled Allahu Akbar, was acting pre-ISIS. What ISIS does is I think it gives direction, organization, and because of its command of the social media, can actually activate people in a way that was more random before. But the general issue is radical Islam. And unless, I mean, we have a president who immediately says this is a lone gunman, how does he know? Well, in the absence of any evidence.
Let me play this soundbite from the Oval Office.
Sure.
Talking to the press pool after meeting with the FBI director, President Obama.
We don't know yet all the details. We know that what appears to be a lone gunman carried out these attacks. We've identified a name. And at this point, a full investigation is taking place. The FBI will be in the lead, working closely with local law enforcement.
You were saying?
When you say lone gunman, what you're doing subtly or unsubtly is disconnecting the dots. When we had the underwear bomber trying to bring down a plane over Detroit, Obama immediately said that this was an isolated extremist. It wasn't, in fact. It turned out to be connected to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So I think it's sort of the 6.5 years of Obama always wanting to err on the side of downplaying the threat. The threat is radical Islam, which he won't say. And look, the war is going to be generational. I think the ISIS part, where it's heightened, concentrated, and directed, and more focused, is something that we can do something about, but that would require destroying them in their homeland.
Let me be careful about this. We may learn that soon. He may well end up being a lone gunman, but I think Charles is right about the president. The president has a history of doing this in his initial statements, downplaying these attacks and suggesting that they're not related to this broader fight that we're not really fighting. One final point on the military installations. It is preposterous that these Marines are not allowed to carry weapons at these things. That is something the president could change right now and should change right now.
Well, Bill O'Reilly saying last night that the shootings in Chattanooga are yet another wake-up call to this nation, and he is urging the president to call this threat what it is.
I firmly believe President Obama is making a major mistake in the tentative nature of his response to ISIS, and I've said that many times. I hope Mr. Obama's strategy will change because ISIS is a direct threat to all Americans, even if it turns out they were not involved in the terror attack today.
Retired U.S. Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North is Fox News military analyst and the author of Counterfeit Lies, and he joins me now. Good to have you here, Colonel North. What do you think about what Bill O'Reilly had to say last night?
Well, first, we all grieve for my Marine brothers and their families, because the toughest job in the world is to have to be a CACO, a Casualty Assistance Contact Officer. We walk up the front steps with a chaplain, and every one of those families had to go through that yesterday.
Wait, let's take a moment then and take, if we can pull up the picture of the first young man who we have a picture of, because I believe that
he was in the group. Henry Sergeant Sullivan, 14th Marines, 14th Marines Artillery Unit reserves called up to help the fight. He was in the battle for Fallujah that won, and a Purple Heart recipient, a hero. What his wife and children are going through is just heartbreaking and totally unnecessary if we were doing the right things here at home. Let me just take on Bill O'Reilly's comment. It's not just ISIS. It's radical Islamic terror. It has been perpetrated against Americans since the early 1980s when they first attacked our embassy in Beirut. It's been going on nonstop since then. 93 was the first World Trade Center attack. For a while, we called it Al-Qaeda. Now they're calling it ISIS. If we simply limit the search for people who are bad people involved in this, we narrow it to the point where, well, gee, he wasn't in touch with ISIS. He was just, quote, radicalized. The idea that you can somehow stop people from learning bad things over the Internet is we're way past that. What we really need to be doing, particularly for the military at home, when my family was threatened by terrorists, the United States government provided 37 federal agents who live with us until I retired from the Marine Corps. I mean, they moved us out of our home, hid us at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, brought us to a safe house, and eventually brought us back home. There are over 100 military families right now who have been threatened by name because their names...
What kind of protection are they getting?
I don't want to give away bad things,
okay.
But not enough.
Yeah.
The reality of it is many of them have to live off base nowadays because they bought a home there. They can't afford to leave it open. And so then they move back to an area like, let's say, Norfolk or Quantico. You got to live aboard the base and you'd lose your home. And so here's what we need to do. Number one, the idea that military personnel can be unarmed or have to be unarmed on a military base is absolutely
lunacy. I mean, you're talking about this Purple Heart recipient,
yes,
who,
yeah,
you know, obviously was trained by the U.S. military,
yes,
to protect himself and to protect others,
exactly,
is left
so
completely vulnerable. And it's my understanding that one signature on one piece of paper,
yes,
would
indeed
allow these guys, these heroes of ours, to just be protected while they're trying to recruit people into the military. I mean, this... Why has that not happened, Colonel
Well,
North?
Because
it's not a big deal. Why is it a big deal?
The commander-in-chief, who could sign that executive order, famous for saying, I have a pen and a telephone, could do that right as we're speaking right here. If you're at the White House right now, sign the executive order releasing that regulation that goes back to 1992 and say everybody on a military base who has a firearm can carry it with them. Number two. The security for that military facility down there was terrible. If you can drive a Mustang through the gate, it's not good. In a couple of hours, I will be aboard a U.S. military installation that has the pop-up barriers, armed military personnel, not civilian guards, at every gate, checking every ID. It's not just because of what happened yesterday. That's the way it's been for 2 years out there. And I'm talking about the hospital over here at Walter Reed. Number three, the families deserve the protection of the government of the United States. And those families who have been threatened need to have that kind of security, not necessarily as big as it was for my family and me, but the fact is they deserve to have that. And lastly, if you want to deal with this thing and end it, destroy ISIS. And we could do that in a matter of months. Doug McElway right now is interviewing a Sunni leader in Iraq who's got a plan to finish it, ISIS, and destroy it, and not give over Iraq to the Iranians. And this administration won't even talk to the man. His name is Mudar Shakat. He's a courageous soldier in the Iran-Iraq war. He's a Sunni leader. And it's the kind of thing that if we did that, nobody wants to be involved. They don't want to be a loser in a losing campaign. Nobody wants to be the last soldier killed in a bad battle. And if we destroyed ISIS, not necessarily every guy, but they would stop wanting to do jihad because ISIS would be losing. And nobody wants to be part of a losing cause.
Call the war what it is and what it has been, as you say, since 1982.
It's a war.
And fight it here and at home.
Yes.
At home and abroad, I should say. And I feel for you and for the families of those lost and for everybody who has such a close emotional connection to our United States Marines, because they are heroes. And they are the best among us, along with the rest of the United States military. I thank you very much, Colonel North. Good to have you here today.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anna. Fox News alert. Four Marines shot dead in this morning. Officials identifying 24-year-old Muhammad Yusuf Abdulaziz as the attacker who opened fire on two military facilities. He was born in Kuwait, was a naturalized U.S. citizen. So what else do we know about him and his possible motive? Helping us sort it out is the president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy and author of A Battle for the Soul of Islam, Dr. Zudi Jasser. Good morning to you. Joining us this morning, we appreciate you helping us try to dive a little bit deeper. What is your sense about what we should have been doing differently to try and stop some hateful crime like this?
Well, Ed, you know, on our biggest Islamic holiday today, it's a solemn occasion to see my brothers and sisters in the Marines horrifically attacked by this terrorist. You know, this is not just terrorism, this is a war. And, you know, you look at this and enough is enough already. When is America going to realize, and our government especially, that we can't predict this? Yes, certainly his blog was, I think, supremacist, but there was nothing violent. So if they're going to use the litmus test of violence to predict when this is going to happen, we are going to lose. We are going to have to begin to have an ideological filter where we as American security begin to look at those who have a supremacist Islamic mindset. It's not just about the organized top-down ISIS, but a bottom-up ideology that believes in the supremacism of the his blog talked about the establishment of Islam. You know, and Americans get this. We fought against theocracy in our American Revolution. It's time to enable Muslims who are fighting against theocracy. This type of radical became radical because he hated America, he hates our military, and he wanted to establish the Islamic State.
Doctor, you make an important point. Let's look at that blog, because he didn't directly say that he was going to go forward with violence. He said troubling things such as, brothers and sisters, don't be fooled by your desires. This life is short and bitter, and the opportunity to submit to Allah may pass you by. His senior yearbook, meanwhile, also went into some of this, saying, my name causes national security alerts. What does yours do? Almost boasting about the fact that he was setting off national security alerts, but again, did not say or suggest that he was going to move forward with a tragic violence like this. Does the FBI have its hands tied right now because of the fact that they have a higher standard of actually going forward with surveillance?
Absolutely. Our hands are tied because they can't monitor. I mean, remember in the Cold War, we even had immigration filters about communist allegiance to communist parties. Today, we can't even ask about Islamist allegiance when, in fact, in Muslim-majority countries, you have large swaths of populations fighting against Islamist movements. They lost the elections in Tunisia. The Brotherhood was ousted because they, in Muslim-majority countries, understand the threat of political Islam because they live it. But in America, we tie our hands. These individuals mock our victimization mantra and hyper-victimization of Muslims. In the meantime, we surrender to political correctness, and we can't empower Muslim reformists who are the only ones, Ed, that could have begun to push identity towards America rather than identity for these global movements that want to strike and will continue to strike until we have a strategy for an American political movement against political Islam.
Doctor, last question. Given your vast background, what is your sense of the likelihood that this was at least ISIS-inspired, if not a direct connection? And what is your message to moderate Muslims? What do they need to do? What do they need to say at a time like this to stop this senseless violence?
Well, remember what ISIS represents. It represents an ideology that believes somewhere, somehow, everywhere it'll establish the Islamic State or Sharia or Islamic law. This is definitely part of that social global movement. Muslims today, as we celebrate our holiest day after Ramadan, I hope after a month of atonement, can sit down and say that it is time, enough is enough. We need to have a strategy to tell our youth that we love America, we would die for America, and we will not die for political Islam and these movements that hate America and hate freedom, because that's the only solution to defeat the viral ideology that infuses people like Abdulaziz.
Enough is enough. Some strong words this morning from Dr. Zudi Jasser. We really appreciate your insight and analysis this morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ed.
Hello? Hello?
Iran's supreme leader says his country's newly brokered nuclear deal will not change Iran's stance toward the U.S. During a speech marking the end of Ramadan, Ayatollah Khamenei said the nuclear deal must go through a legal process before being approved, and he asked that Iranian officials put national interests first. The supreme leader declared that Iran will continue to support Syria and its other allies, whether the deal is approved or not.
Our policies will not change vis-a-vis the arrogant government of the United States at all. Death to America, death to Great Britain, death to Israel, death to the hypocrites. The hypocrites meaning the MEK, and finally death to Israel. As we have repeated multiple times, with the United States, we have no talks vis-a-vis regional issues.
Khamenei's remarks were greeted by chants of death to America. As Iran's supreme leader, he has the final word on all policy matters, foreign and domestic, including that nuclear deal.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
meeting everywhere in the world that ever took place with the Iranians, we have raised the issue of the American citizens, and we are working on the issue of the American citizens even now.
That was Secretary of State John Kerry talking about the four Americans detained or missing in Iran. They were left out of the nuclear deal, as was any clauses that might secure their freedom in the future. Now, the wife of one of the American prisoners is urging Congress to reject the accord, saying it's the best leverage the U.S. has to free her husband. Joining us now, Nagma Abedini, wife of Saeed Abedini, an American pastor jailed in Iran for his Christian faith, and Jordan Sekulow, executive director of the American Center for Law and Justice, who's been working to secure his release. Jordan, start with you. When you hear the Secretary of State say, we're working very hard, this is a top priority, President Obama obviously got into a little spat with a reporter about this, saying this is a priority of mine, do you believe him?
Not really. I think maybe now, maybe that this 60-day congressional review, there's some members of Congress, you've talked to some of them already today, who are concerned about this deal and maybe leaning even against voting for it, even members of the president's own party, who are looking towards for something out of Iran that's concrete, and maybe that's the release of these Americans. So there may be some focus now. But you know, we said it last week before the deal, and I know Nagma feels this way as well, that it would be unconscionable for the administration to put forward to Congress, and that being then the American people, a final nuclear deal with Iran without securing the release of these Americans. And that's exactly what the White House did.
Naima, when you have had your dealings with the administration and you've talked to them and talked to folks from the State Department who are in charge of securing the release of Americans abroad, do you get the feeling that your husband is someone that they don't really care about, is a lost cause, or do you think it's something that they're deeply concerned about?
You know, I do think they're concerned about it. I think they are working on it. It was not as high of a priority as the deal. But I'd hope that even before we made the deal, at least on the sidelines, or even before we start talking with Iran, that his secure would have been released. I think we're losing more leverage as we're moving forward with the deal. But I want to say that really, too, it was really emotional hearing that my husband was not released, and yet we moved forward with the deal. But you know, through the ups and downs, it's been really emotional and devastating for our family. But I feel like God has told me, and a lot of, you know, our nation is facing the same thing, a lot of uncertainties and ups and downs, that it's really to look to him and that he would protect and he would heal our nation once we turn our eyes back to Jesus.
And I'm interested in sort of what your husband's view of this is. Have you heard from him at all? Is he had any contact outside of prison where he may know that a deal was made and he wasn't part of it, or has he largely or entirely been cut off from communications with you in the outside world?
No, we were able to correspond. He sees his father once a week in prison. His father saw him after the deal was made, and Saeed had also hoped that he would be freed before a final deal had been made. But he's still hoping, and my daughter's birthday is in a few months. She'll turn 9, and he's still hoping that he would be able to make it to her birthday. It's just been very emotional for him as well.
This would be the third birthday that he's missed, right?
The fourth, actually. It's pretty horrific, but it will be the fourth birthday.
Fourth birthday that is missed, fourth Christmas, fourth holidays, fourth Easter. Jordan, is there anything that you have found that can help any other back channel other than the U.S. government to be able to go through? Can the Qataris or Emiratis help you guys out, or does this simply have to be a U.S. government operation to try to get him out?
We pursued those channels, Leland, and we continue to do so with other countries, but let's just remember the facts are that America negotiated this deal, took the lead. It's the world power. These are Americans. So other countries are looking for America to lead. If they need their help, they've got to make that clear. And so far, the U.S. has wanted to kind of direct this, so it's been more difficult because these are Americans. I want to remind people, if President Obama is not content about this, he's got to really take action, not just words, because the Supreme Leader of Iran in yesterday's close of Ramadan speech said nothing's changing with the United States. To me, that's a direct signal even about these Americans. And so it's so important right. That it's not just Saeed, it's the other Americans as well. We've got to get home. It's a tough situation for them in the prisons right now, very tough, because the anti-American sentiment is high.
I think all our viewers could imagine an Iranian prison is a pretty awful place to be. As you said, we need American leadership. We'll see if we get it on this and other issues. Nagma Abedini, whose husband is in Iran, imprisoned there, has been for a long time. We hope he can make it home for your daughter's birthday. Jordan Sekulow, thanks for your work on this as well. We appreciate it.
And so women fall underneath Sharia, and everything from the cradle to the grave is put into the Sharia about how they're to live. And we're talking about how they should live. And we talked a little bit about this last week, but just give me in general some of the rules. If you're a woman in Islam, how are you raised? How do you think about men and marriage? Let's talk about that.
Well, the fourth chapter of the Quran, Nisa, the fourth book, if you will, Surah 4, has this entire outlay of what marriage is supposed to be. A man is allowed to have two, three, or four wives if he wishes. A woman can have just one husband. And in no uncertain terms, the woman is considered part and parcel, like cherished commodity. She is the one being the property. One of the citations in the Hadith, Book 22, where Muhammad turns and says, women are a plaything. Take your pick. You know, Surah 3, verse 14, it talks about the woman. They try to say it in terms of nobility, but there's no question. A woman is proper to be held. And just like your home, just like your children, the man is not only over top, but the woman is filling hell, two-thirds. The woman is no property rights. The woman has no personal rights except through her husband.
How about this thing of the way she dresses? Why is she dressed the way that she is with the veil?
Well, from her demeanor, she is to lower her gaze, Surah 24:31, to her covering. That is, she has the responsibility of making sure other men are not tempted by her body, by her figure. And if so, if she wears tight-fitting clothes and a man is tempted, the responsibility falls upon her as the temptress. And therefore, they have to be covered. So in places like Saudi Arabia today, you have modesty police. These are literal police who stand on the street, helped and led by women who point to other women who aren't dressed properly according to Saudi protocol. And they are to dress properly. And until such time, they are slapped on the back of their legs, on their thighs, so they go into a shop and dress properly. And so this is a literal sense in an Islamic Renaissance where the Quran is once again being taken literally. In this post-colonial world, this is the Islam, not only of old, but back being new again. You know, in Islam, when it says the majority of inhabitants in hell are women, and a stark irony is because it says they are ungrateful to their husbands. That is, a woman goes to hell not because what she did against Allah, but what she did being ungrateful to her husband and what he's given her. And the beauty of the gospel is that Christ loves her, died for her, can set her free from this bondage. And whatever else happens spiritually, she is made in the image of God to have a relationship with God that she can speak to the Lord, and the Lord will speak to her, and she can be sure she's going to heaven, not because she is good, but because he is good, and he died in her place. And the beauty is, he is called her Heavenly Father, and that's the true picture of Father.
We're talking about Islam and women. And I said we were going to talk about if an Islamic woman, 700 million of them out there in the Muslim world, if some of them that are single have interest in a Muslim man, how is it they can get together? Is there anything that they can do? I said, is it possible for them to date? You laughed. Tell me why you laughed.
Well, there's no such thing as dating in the Islamic world, at least in the traditional Islamic world, in the West, if they've accepted some more moderate rights there. But the father has right over his daughter. So in Niger, he can give her away even before puberty. In Yemen, 50% of all women are married off by the father's consent and approval before they're 15 years old. In Iran, it's 12 years old and he can hand over. That is, it's the father's right to hand over either because another man thinks she's beautiful, or there's wealth behind her, or her family wants to connect with another family. Those are the issues that Aisha say makes a woman ready for marriage. And so there is a youngness to it that we in the West would say, well, hold on, she's not ready at any age or at 12. I have two daughters, they're not going to be ready by 15. there is an Islamic value system that we would hold as absolutely abhorrent.
I was haunted by the words of Aisha in the Hadith, who at what, 9 years of age, she says, "I'm swinging on the swing," mm-hmm. and tell me the rest.
Well, she's playing as a child. And then Hadith volume 7, number 64, Muhammad says he consummates the marriage with her when she's 9 years old. Now, even though Muslims will try to justify one way or another or say she was a bit older, this is codified in their constitution. And so they have to struggle with a verse that they cannot deny, but many Muslims struggle with experientially being fathers and mothers.
And this is where it's very ironic that it's the United Nations, you have the OIC, you have, what, 57 countries that are arguing for Sharia law, for that kind of thing to be implemented in all of those countries. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, where is the world in terms of saying we can't go with that? And turning down the Human Rights Declaration of the United Nations, we're just not going to obey that. Okay? So these are some of the reasons I want to bring these things up in the program. I think it's time for the Christians to understand what Islamic women are experiencing right now while we are living and say this is wrong. And also, it's not truth. All right.
There's a peace I've come to know, though my heart and flesh may fail. There's an anchor for my soul, I can say it is well. and the grave is overwhelmed. The victory is won. He is risen from the dead, and I will rise when he calls my name. No more sorrow, no more pain. I will rise on eagle's wings before my God. Fall on my knees and rise. I will rise. There's a day that's drawing near when this darkness breaks to light and the shadows disappear, and my faith shall be my eyes. Jesus has overcome, and the grave is overwhelmed. The victory is won. He is risen. My God.
the curve.